and gentlemen, we have one case for argument this morning, United States against Blagojevich, the appeal of the Chicago Tribune and three other press organizations. Ms. Spears.
May it please the Court, good morning. Natalie Spears on behalf of the press interveners, appellants, and thank you for granting oral argument in this matter. We ask that you reverse the district court's order and grant immediate access to the prospective and seated jurors in this ongoing criminal trial. In this courthouse, there have been many high-profile cases, trials of former governors, aldermen, other public officials, other high-profile cases, and the juror names in those cases have traditionally and historically been open during voir dire and during trial. Openness during jury selection and trial is a
yes. You're addressing the merits, but of course the antecedent question is whether your client should be allowed to intervene. That was the only thing the district court decided. I think one should start there, and you will also need to address the question whether your opening brief even preserves that question for decision. Because your opening brief is written as if the district court had allowed your clients to intervene and then decided adversely. But as I say, the district court's decision was that your client's request to intervene was untimely. So we need to address first whether you have preserved that question in your opening brief, and then whether the district court's decision is correct. And only after that would we be getting to the merits.
Your Honor, first of all, the district court's ruling as to timeliness was an error. This court has held that the press and the public, and the United States Supreme Court has held that the press and the public seeking to assert the right of public access must be given an opportunity to be heard in a manner that gives full protection to the asserted right. That's in the Globe.
Let me just maybe focus you a little bit more in the direction I think my colleague is going. Your opening brief, the blue brief, discusses on page 3 and page 4, and then there's some footnotes, the timing of the motion that you made to intervene. Your motion was, as I recall, on the 1st of June of this year, and then the district court denied it 2 days later. Then, though, if you look at the actual headings in your argument section, it appears to address only the merits. And so I think the initial question that we need to resolve is whether you sufficiently ventilated the question of the timing in your blue brief, because obviously, as you know, this court doesn't allow people to raise things for the first time in their reply briefs.
Well, Your Honor, I think certainly we did address the issue of intervention being proper. And in terms of the timeliness issue that was part of the judge's decision, the judge did not only rule on timeliness, he also went to the merits.
Well, I know that, but timeliness alone would be enough if let's suppose you made your motion today for the first time. Any district judge would be well within his rights to say, sorry, it's too late. The trial's been going on for a couple of weeks. Nobody would get to these very important First Amendment questions. You made your motion on the 1st of June. I understand from what you've said that the district judge was musing about this back in June of 2009, but then that the press learned pretty definitively on May 17th that the judge was going to handle the juror names as he has done. And so the question that doesn't receive very much, it receives a little bit of attention, maybe it's enough, but it doesn't receive much attention in your brief, is whether that two-week period of time was just too long.
Well, I'd like to address that squarely. First of all, I do believe it's sufficiently raised in the briefs and also discussed in the reply briefs. The trial is ongoing, so even if
Where did you raise this in your brief? Now, I understand that you mention this aspect of the district court's decision in footnote 3. But where do you raise this and argue as an issue what legal standards apply to the timeliness of these motions? Footnote 3 just says the district court did this. It doesn't present what looks like a legal argument. So where do you present that legal argument in your brief?
Well, I think, Your Honor, inherent in the in the briefs itself is the issue that intervention was appropriate and that the court has the ability to look at this.
Your brief doesn't discuss whether intervention was appropriate. Your brief assumes, the whole argument section of your brief assumes that your clients were allowed to intervene and then argues the merits. Footnote 3 mentions that the district court found the motion untimely. I'm asking where the argument came. There is a clear argument on this subject in your reply brief. But as Judge Wood said, it's in this footnote. I think it's in this footnote. Is there any place other than footnote 3 that you want me to look at to see where you have argued this in your brief?
Well, Your Honor, in the text of the statement of the case, inherent in the statement there, we have set forth that we didn't.
Arguments go in argument sections. They don't go in the statement of the case. In fact, the rules say that the statement of the case and the statement of fact shall be free of argument. So if your contention is that by noting this in the statement of fact, you've made an argument, that's just a contention that you violated the rule that that section of the brief contained no argument.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that it's inherent in the brief as well as in footnote 3, but let me address the point about the timing. Even if this trial is ongoing, even if we were to come today to a district court, the right of access to names of the jurors is ongoing during trial. It's not just a right that evaporates when the trial begins. And regarding the May 17th date.
For the proposition that you've just stated, because I did understand that to be a point you were making, what are you relying on? Press Enterprises 1? Or what authority do you have for the notion that even if you were to file a new motion today with the trial court judge, that A, the judge would need to grant that motion to allow you to intervene, and then B, the judge would have to rule favorably on your request for the juror names?
Press Enterprise 1, in part, is that, Your Honor, taking up an issue that voir dire is open to the public. It is difficult to discern that voir dire would be open to the public, and the criminal trial the Supreme Court has held is the most important aspect to the citizens of the United States is a criminal trial, one of the most important aspects. The voir dire is open, and yet the names of the jurors, the 12 citizens entrusted with deciding the fate of a criminal defendant, would not be open to the public. And certainly there are instances where the trial would be ongoing, and a member of the public could ask for access to information in an earlier stage, and if denied, that would be not extinguished simply because it was not asked for previously. Also, as to the May 17th hearing, that's not what Judge Zagel was relying on in terms of his ruling that we were untimely. He said we should have made the motion 30 or 60 days ago, relying on the fact that he made some statement a year ago to the extent that he was considering looking at the issue.
Well, the media didn't ignore that statement. Weren't there a number of articles written in the mainstream media and on various media-related blogs about the potential for an anonymous jury, even a year before the jury?
There's one that the government cites in its brief, but, Your Honor,
and there are others, aren't there?
Your Honor, I'm aware of the one that the government cites in his brief in the record. I'm not aware of other points in the record to that effect, but that is not concrete enough to extinguish the right of access. And if the right of access exists during...
No, but it puts the media on notice that this is an issue that Judge Zagel's concerned about and has given his position where he is on that as of a year prior to the jury selection process.
So that's not concrete, a finding such to give the press and the public adequate notice
but
that it's something that could be raised.
There are these other cases. You talk about cases that have where juror names have been released. There are other cases, like the Conrad Black case, very visible case, where they were not. So there's no firm rule on that in that district.
And there's other cases where traditionally and typically where they are. So it's an unusual decision to do that. And it's not concrete enough. And frankly, it should go
that,
both.
That Conrad Black decision wasn't concrete enough to put the media on notice that if they want the juror names in advance, they ought to do something?
Well, we did do something in advance. We filed prior to the time the jurors were even in to fill out their questionnaires, prior to voir dire. And while
on the
trial
cusp of it, really, though.
Well, on the cusp of it, but before it started, Your Honor. And if we had come to the court while the trial was ongoing, it would still be a live right that we're entitled to. And what the district court did in not allowing...
Okay. What I now understand you to be saying is that there's no such thing as a timeliness requirement when the media wants information in a criminal case. Is there some decision that we should look at to establish that proposition? Is it something that we or the Supreme Court has held?
I'm not saying that there's no timeliness issue. I'm saying that we were timely, Your Honor. If a right exists and it's ongoing during trial.
You're saying no matter when we filed this, it's timely. That's the same thing as saying there's no such thing as a timeliness requirement. So what case do you want me to look at to establish the proposition that it just doesn't matter when you file?
Well,
right? What Judge Zagel said is that the jurors' names will be disclosed at the end of the trial. You're saying you could move to intervene any time until the very day when the names are bound to be disclosed. I'm just looking for legal authority on that proposition. What do you want me to look at?
Your Honor, I would say, first of all, in the Press Enterprise case, in the United States Supreme Court cases and in Globe, the right of intervention exists if the constitutional right exists, and therefore it would be appropriate, if as long as the right is still live and valid, which this right is, to be allowed to intervene. And also in ABC versus Stewart.
Counsel, you have to stop talking so you can hear the question.
Sure.
I don't believe there was any issue raised about the timeliness of motions to intervene in those cases. Is your understanding different? Was there an issue raised about timeliness in those cases?
No, but even in this
case. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we need, if we're looking for rules about timeliness, we need cases where timeliness is an issue. That's what I'm asking, if you have some case you want me to look at where timeliness was an issue, where it was raised and decided.
In this court's decision in Ray Associated Press, the case came up on intervention and under the court's collateral order doctrine looked at the issue while the issues were ongoing. That suggests that while something is ongoing during proceedings, it would be timely. In the Second Circuit's case of ABC versus Stewart, the court looked at voir dire, and the issues were raised by the time it got up to the appellate court.
Counsel, maybe I'm not clear, although I think I'm clear. Are those cases where an objection was made that the motion was untimely and where the court of appeals or Supreme Court, adjudicated an issue about timeliness?
Not specifically, Your Honor, but they are cases which suggest by virtue of the posture that
there is no holding in a case unless the parties join issue on something and the court decides something, right? If the United States had not urged timeliness or if Judge Zagel had not made a timeliness ruling in this case, we wouldn't be talking about it here either. But courts don't establish precedents on things that the lawyers have never raised for decision. That's why I'm looking. Your brief doesn't cite any cases on this point. I just wonder whether there are any, and if so, what they are.
Your Honor, if I could move to the issue that the judge also looked at in the lower court on the merits, which is the issue of whether or not there was access. I don't have a case for you specifically on timeliness. If we did, in our reply brief, however, discuss it at great length, and in that respect, I think that this court, when a trial is ongoing and expected to last 15 to 17 weeks, would have a right to look at an issue. If there's a constitutional right of access that's being infringed, this court, as well as Judge Zagel, should look at that issue and decide it promptly.
All right. Let's get to the merits, and let me ask you a question about a Supreme Court case that not discussed. It's Gannett Company against DePasquale. In DePasquale, there are two issues with the closing of the preliminary hearing. One was whether that violated the constitutional right to a public trial. And the second was whether it violated any right of access that the press might have. And the Supreme Court said, with respect to the access claim, no. This is at pages 391 to 93 of the Supreme Court's opinion, saying no, there's no access claim if the information is released at the end of the trial. Now, you're making an access claim that seems to say we do have an access claim, even though the information will be released at the end of the trial. And I wonder how that's consistent with what the holding of with the holding of Gannett.
Well, Gannett versus DePasquale was decided before Richmond News in 1980, before Press Enterprise 1, which decided a right to voir dire, and before Press Enterprise 2. So I think that needs to be looked at in that context. Second of all, if you look at it in that context.
I'm lost. Are you saying that Press Enterprise 1 overruled this portion of Gannett without saying so?
No, what I'm saying is that if you look simply at that proposition, had a trial been conducted entirely in secret and then published the videos or the transcripts afterwards, that certainly is not what Gannett was saying.
That would violate the right to a public trial. That's why I'm saying there are separate Roman numeral headings in Gannett. One Roman numeral heading deals with the right to a public trial. The other deals with the press claim of rights of access. And the Supreme Court said, well, first, the press doesn't have any rights of access, see Kleindienst against Mandel. But even if we assume that we're prepared to change those cases, we wouldn't change them, wouldn't create any rights of access, when the information is going to be released at the end of the trial anyway. So there's no First Amendment right of access to release before the end of the trial. Now, that's what Gannett held.
But that's not.
But let me ask you the question perhaps in a different way. Gannett says those things in the context of the transcript of a suppression hearing. And that's not, of course, what's at issue in Press Enterprises 1. Press Enterprises 1 is about voir dire proceedings. So I suppose one other way of phrasing it is how broadly is Gannett sweeping? Is it focusing on each particular incident of the criminal trial, or is it making some grand rule about late disclosure or disclosure at the end of a trial is always enough?
Right.
I think it would be focusing just on a specific instance there, particularly in context of the later decisions of the Supreme Court in Press Enterprise 1. Also, with regard to that, the entire process, if you look at a specific process such as voir dire and say it is instrumental to our criminal justice system and should be a matter of public record, it is very hard to reconcile that with the fact that the names of the jurors wouldn't be made public at the time. By delaying it, you're delaying the benefits of access.
You're essentially saying that one form of access is, if you will, the free flow of information. And you're saying that when there's essentially a gag order about something, here the names of the jurors, that that's a form of denial of access.
Absolutely. If the right is not contemporaneously validated, the benefits of the right are lost.
Ms. Spears, don't the parties here have the names of the jurors?
Yes, they do.
Are they prohibited from disclosing? Can your clients go to the counsel for the parties and say, who's juror number 103?
Well, given that Judge Zagel has ruled that he's not making them available to the press and the public, I think inherent in that.
Has he ordered the parties not to disclose the names?
I don't believe that there is an order in the record to that effect.
But it's your understanding that you would be violating the spirit of what he's done if you just went to the parties and got the names.
Correct. And the fact that the parties have the name is not enough. The public has a right. As this court has said, Judge Easterbrook, as you have said in the Union Oil case, what goes on in the halls of this courthouse is the people's business. How could the people not have a right to know during a criminal trial the 12 individuals who are deciding the fate of the defendant, in this case our former governor? That right, if access is not prompt, access delayed is effectively access denied. We're entitled to have the information about what's going on, when it's going on, not after the fact. If we were to hold an entire criminal trial in secret, even though it was videotaped and you could see the impressions and expressions, and then release it afterwards, no one would say after Richmond News in 1980 that that was acceptable, that the part of...
Counsel, that you're mixing up two questions. One has to do with the public trial guarantee of the Sixth Amendment, and the other has to do with the First Amendment. Now, it is apparently agreed that the names of these jurors have never been said in open court. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So cases dealing with who can repeat what's said in open court don't apply. What you have to be saying is that there's a right of access to information that has never been said in open court. Now, that's one reason why I raised Gannett. And the Supreme Court started in, this is part four of Gannett, with the proposition that it had in the past rejected rights of access to filed by people who wanted access to information that was not in the public domain. And it was being asked in Gannett to modify or change those cases. Right? Has the Supreme Court established a right of access, a general right of access, since Gannett?
The Supreme Court has established a right of access to the voir dire process, Your Honor, in Press Enterprise 1. And the only reason that the names were not stated in open court is that they were on a questionnaire. You can't put in a written document to avoid what has happened in public courthouses and in this courthouse historically and traditionally to evaporate and eviscerate that right. I'd like to reserve the remaining time for reply.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Ms. Bonamici.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. Beginning with the issue of timeliness, I must first say that it would appear that the government, by not raising the potential waiver of the timeliness issue by the by our opponent, could be seen by the court as having waived the waiver. So we acknowledge that fact. However, the court does not need to accept our waiver, and we don't express an opinion regarding the briefs.
But, you know, I'll tell you what worries me at the first instance, putting the briefs to one side. I am very uncomfortable with a rule that requires people to guess about what the district court is really doing and when it's going to do it. And the thing that is just glaring by its absence in this record is anything that the district court bothers to put on the docket until actually the June 3rd ruling. What he actually says in the June of 2009 ruling that you're relying on is, my assumption is that the government does not intend to ask for an anonymous jury in this case, but I have given some consideration to public anonymity of the jurors, at least until the trial is over. And that's all he says, and one could understand that as, you know, I don't even know if this is going to come up, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't. It's extremely vague. It only gets renewed at this May 17th proceeding in the afternoon, when again, I mean, with 708 entries on the docket by this time, the judge doesn't go so far as to just put an entry on the docket saying, here's how I'm going to handle the jury, at which point there's something concrete that people can intervene about. I have visions of the press filing intervention motions every other day about hypotheticals they may come up with, and that would be very burdensome to the district court.
Right, and let me make clear that the government is not arguing that the court's statement in June of 2009 set the deadline for the interveners to attempt to intervene.
The judge seems to have thought so, because he says, you should have come in 30 or 60 days in advance. And as far as this record is concerned, there's just nothing 30 or 60 days in advance to trigger that, and the government actually does mention that June 2009 hearing. You start out on page 3 of your brief with that.
Well, we chronologically describe the series of events, but I think the point that the court was trying to make is that it is not as though May 17th was the first day that this topic was ever mentioned.
Where am I supposed to find anything in the record?
Well, Your Honor, I think
where this was discussed before.
And I hear what you're saying about the docket.
So in other words, nowhere.
No, I would say that the court made these statements in open court. And in
what
this case, Your Honor.
What statement in open court other than the June 1, 2009 statement did the court make prior to this off-the-record May 17 discussion? No one has furnished me, anyway, with any excerpts of transcripts.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that there was another open court statement. But, Your Honor, in this case, you need to at least take into consideration that the circumstances of this case are that every single hearing, every status that happens in that courtroom is attended by members of the media. And if that weren't, if that particular fact isn't on the record, it's obvious from the media accounts of all of those hearings. And in fact,
I've had a real problem imagining, I mean, I have visions of civil trials and criminal trials. You know, things are happening and nobody, neither side, has furnished us, you know, specifics of when this ruling was actually made. I think it's terribly unfair to hold people to a time schedule that requires mind reading.
Well, I would say, Your Honor, that if what we're talking about is an entry on the docket, then that's a fair observation.
And it doesn't but given happen that until this June case, 3rd.
But given that this case involves not only open court proceedings that are attended by members of every media outlet you can imagine, but beyond that, a special meeting scheduled by the judge and in fact also the chief judge to meet with the media prior to the trial
to
discuss.
And that's the May 17 meeting,
that's
right?
The May 17th
so
meeting.
So it seems to me our time frame here, being generous to this district court judge, who I wish had, you know, at least focused in a way that's capable of review, May 18, the Chicago Tribune, you've indicated, and everybody agrees, reports the decision. It sounds like now it's a decision not to release the name. So it seems to me we're down to a two-week period.
We are. And I would say, Your Honor, that 2 weeks is a pretty short period under other circumstances. But in this circumstance, what the press also knew was that the trial was scheduled to begin and jury selection was scheduled to begin on June 3rd.
Right. So
and that the jurors
were 2 days before that.
That's right. They waited until 2 days before that and even then failed to file an emergency motion before the judge and noticed the hearing up for the very day that jury selection was scheduled to begin and the day after it had been publicly announced the jurors were scheduled to arrive to fill out their juror questionnaires.
Right. But, you know, listen to what you're saying. I mean, most of the time when we decide cases, we decide them on the basis of harder information than just everybody knew that. I mean, we don't typically do this.
But it's not simply a matter of everybody knew. There are transcript citations where the matters are discussed. And in particular, the question
what
of...
What transcript citations are you talking about?
The ones that are attached to our brief. The citation to the June 2009 case, which I know
which
that...
Which you just said you weren't relying on, so I'm...
Well, we're not relying exclusively on that. We think the court... It was not unreasonable for the court to expect the interveners to attempt to intervene earlier than they did, based on the fact that he had publicly stated in a hearing where members of the media, including the members of the media that are part of the intervening group here, were present. We
okay,
don't think
you've
that...
You've also attached this May 17 morning hearing, but the morning hearing is just about the questionnaires. It just says the questionnaires are going to be filled out. I looked at the whole thing in vain for anything about keeping the names of the jurors.
What the morning questionnaire says is that the jurors will be in the next day to fill out the juror questionnaires.
It says, not the May 17 morning thing. He's talking about how many peremptories.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He's talking about the questionnaires will be filled out on June 2. It's a very unsatisfactory way of proceeding. And if the government wanted these juror names to be confidential, it seems to me the government has an interest in this case as well, confidential vis-a-vis the press, obviously.
Right.
Now, could I ask you, is it your understanding that it would have violated Judge Zagel's order if the media representatives had gone to the defendants, for example, and gotten the names and then just published them?
I don't think that there's any order that binds the media representatives. I think realistically...
So do you think Judge Zagel would have regarded that as entirely consistent with his order?
Are we talking only about the media representatives asking, or are we talking about the defendants telling?
Defendants telling and the media people publishing the names.
I think it would not be a violation for the media representatives to ask. I think more likely than not, the defendants, and certainly the government, would have not provided that information without seeking permission from the court.
Is there an order?
There is no order. There is no order.
Is there any kind of gag order in force in this case?
No, there isn't, Your Honor. Recently, the court or the defendants agreed to certain restrictions in lieu of a gag order, and the court, I believe the court.
What restrictions did they agree to?
It has nothing to do with the juror names, Your Honor. It has to do with what the comments that they were making every day after the witnesses testified. So it doesn't have anything to do with the juror names. And there is no order. But I think that I personally would not do that.
The questionnaires the prospective jurors filled out, did the questionnaire tell the prospective jurors their names were going to be held until after?
No, it's my understanding that it didn't. However, the prospective jurors were informed orally, first by a member of the court staff and then by Judge Zagel himself.
And that was all off the record, too. The media doesn't learn about that until the day after the judge has told them this.
That's true. I mean, that's true. But I don't know that the media has any right of access to communications between the judge and
the judge has made a promise of some substantive importance if there is an issue about this access. Now, let me ask you some questions. Do you think that if Judge Zagel had ruled that there would be a curtain in front of the jury through the entire trial and they would just listen through this curtain so that nobody could see who they were, that would be consistent with the First Amendment right of the public and the press to attend?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because I think that Press Enterprises, one, makes the point that there is something to observe in court. But I would say to you that...
So what if the jurors had had paper bags over their heads with little eye slots cut out so that they could see perfectly well and all the rest of you could see them squirming around or falling asleep or whatever they're doing?
I don't. But I think that is so far from what we're talking about here. We're talking about here the temporary withholding of public disclosure of the names.
Fans of the New Orleans Saints used to attend their games before they improved their performance.
Before they improved.
So, I mean, to me, that is so far. What is important here to consider is the two facts, one that was brought up during the earlier argument, and that is that this is a temporary withholding of public disclosure of names.
Right.
And
no,
two,
and two,
the names of the juror, for purposes of the First Amendment, which is intended to protect the right of the people to be informed so they may govern themselves, the identities of jurors who they don't know from Adam is absolutely not the important part.
Well, you're making an assumption that may not be at all correct. Some other courts of appeals have seen this differently. And I have to say, one of Judge Zagel's reasons for this struck me as, I'll say at best, ironic. He said, well, yes, the press did perform a very important function in getting the names of the jurors out in the Ryan trial, but we've now, trust us, we've now incorporated all the safeguards that we realize as a result of the press's work from the Ryan trial we should have done. But one could certainly turn that around and say it turns out that in a big urban society such as Chicago and the greater Northern District of Illinois, press access to names is a pretty good substitute for what I believe it was the Fourth Circuit commented. If you get to rural areas of this country today, or if you get to an earlier time, nobody needed to worry about press access to names. The reporter lived in the town. They'd go in. They'd say, it's old Joe up here called for jury duty. This is a new problem.
No, I think you're exactly right, Your Honor. But I do think it's very, very important to recognize that the type of investigation that is being envisioned here and that took place in the Ryan case came with a downside. And that downside is a very, very serious one, and that is investigations conducted of jurors while a trial is ongoing can be themselves the prejudicial outside influences that can affect the jury's ability to fairly and impartially decide the case.
But let's separate a couple of things. I think the Black opinion does this. There's one question, which is whether the press has a right to the juror names in general. The second question is whether that's an absolute right or a qualified right. And the third question, if you decide it's a qualified right, which it seems to me, reading the cases, it is, is what does it take to overcome that right to access? And certainly in trials like the Family Secrets Trial, where there are real serious questions of juror safety, confidentiality of juror names is well justified by juror safety. There may be other reasons, perhaps in the Conrad Black case itself, the findings of fact might have indicated that to preserve the jury you had to do that. It all got mushed together in this case, and the only reason you can see the judge talking about is that he's afraid people are going to blog, but that reminds me a lot of the Supreme Court's recent decision in Presley against Georgia, where the court says, you've given a reason that's going to apply to every single trial. You've got to do better than that. And if you do give a reason for that overcomes that qualified privilege, you've got to justify it. You've got to consider less restrictive alternatives. Maybe there weren't any here. I don't know. But there's no record.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, may I make 4 points? The first one is, the reason that the record, in my judgment, the reason that the record on this motion is so truncated is because of the timing of the intervener's attempt to intervene. But as to the first question, the government does not believe that there is a First Amendment right to juror names. And here's why. We don't, number one, there's no Supreme Court decision that says that, and of course this court has not made that pronouncement. Number two, in fact, in Press Intervenors 1, the court recognized that that the important information was the sensitive information that related to the juror's impartiality, and suggested and actually faulted the district court for failing to consider allowing the disclosure of that sensitive information while keeping the identity of the jurors confidential. So I think that decision alone, and that's not the only one, there are lots of comments in the cases that make clear that withholding public disclosure of juror names is the least restrictive option in a setting like this.
Well maybe.
And
now,
would you feel the same way
if it were the judges? Suppose we had voice concealers and you came up here and we had, and you just didn't know which three judges you were appearing before. Would you regard that as at all significant?
Well, I'd be appearing before you, which I think is one distinction. I think, personally, it's my judgment that knowing the jurors' identities after the trial satisfies any possible need for accountability, for assurances of fairness.
Not really, because you'd rather fix problems in advance. If there really were, you know, a relative of one of the key witnesses sitting on the jury, why waste a whole trial and require a new trial?
Well, Your Honor, the problem with that...
The information in the George Ryan case had come out only after trial. There might not have been an affirmance on appeal.
That's true, but wouldn't it have been a lot more helpful had it come out during jury selection? So basically...
It would have been more helpful if it had come out during jury selection, but given that it didn't, better that it came out late than after the end of the trial.
I don't know, Judge.
Now, of course, Judge Zagel never thought about that problem, and I must say I share Judge Wood's concern that if you're going to make an order like this, there ought to be some focused presentation where the judge says, I'm considering doing this, let's have a hearing on X, let's consider the reasons for it, let's consider the alternatives to it, and of course if the district judge had done that, it would have been clear when the time for intervention was. But since the judge didn't do it, that kind of record just isn't here.
Well, I'm not going to disagree with that piece of it, although I will say that had the interveners moved expeditiously after May 17th, there would have been more time to resolve these issues. Instead, the judge receives the motion at a time while he's engaged in final preparations for a lengthy trial, a great number of jurors coming in to fill out questionnaires the next day. He is handling multiple motions filed by the parties in the case.
But there's nothing about the identity of these people that he needed. It was a generic ruling. It was, yes, the names are going to be available as they usually are in this building, or no, they aren't. I mean, I can't see what difference actually the timing made to the judge's ability to make a ruling on it. He wasn't going to say this person's name and not that person's name. There's nothing particular about it.
Well, his view was that the timing was such that intervention ought to be denied.
Well, but I know he said that, but what was lost by the timing? We don't even know that, actually. All he has to do is explain himself, which he only does by giving a reason that frankly applies to every single case in every court in the United States today, namely that people have access to the Internet when they go home at night and maybe some blogger reaches them.
Your Honor, I think that's a little bit of an unfair characterization of the judge's concerns. This is a case in which the media coverage and attention is exponentially greater than any of the cases that are listed by our opponents.
So you
and really any
the more public interest there is in a case, the less media access.
Well, Your Honor, I would say that public interest includes both news and entertainment. There's a substantial amount of the interest in this case has really nothing to do with the interests that are protected by the First Amendment.
Why do you say that? That implies that there's no First Amendment interest in, you know, the Real Housewives of New Jersey or something. And frankly,
well, this
you
particular,
know, we're not about to tell them they can't air.
I think it's fair to say that access to court. I think it's fair to say that access to court proceedings is focused on a different aspect of First Amendment freedom.
We don't.
Counsel, let me put this in a different way. Seems to me we could forget the First Amendment here. The decisions of this case, of this court, like Unocal, talking about public access to the records of cases, aren't based on the First Amendment. They're based on what the Supreme Court has described as a common law tradition of access. Now, we take the First Amendment out of this and say the press doesn't have any access rights, but we've got this longstanding common law entitlement to access. We still need to know what a district judge can or should or must do before he overrides that. That is, we need to make a decision as a judiciary about the right procedures, and we might worry at the very end of that whether the Constitution trumps what we think is a wise and sound procedure. But one shouldn't start with the Constitution. Do you think it's a wise and sound procedure, after the common law fashion, for a judge to announce anonymity peremptorily instead of holding a hearing, giving notice, and trying to think about alternatives?
Well, it's a trick question. I don't. But I don't think that's what happened here. I think that, first of all, I don't think that the common law tradition of openness applies particularly to juror names, and I think we know that, as we argued in the brief, by looking at the federal jury selection statute.
No, I don't think that statute helps you as much as you think it helps you. And I think if you go to this, I hesitate to call it a test. People call it the experience and logic test, but that seems really strange to me.
Right.
But I do think...
Applying the word test is some kind of lawyer's in-joke.
But I do think that... if you go back to the history of our country, no one would have thought to even think about juror names because everybody knew everybody. But I've looked carefully at this statute, and it actually draws a distinction between publicizing the names drawn from the qualified jury wheel and then further the names of the actual jury who is chosen. The plan in the Northern District of Illinois makes the same distinction and says... you don't make public the names as they're drawn from the wheel, but the interesting statement in the plan is any judge of this court may order that the names involved remain confidential if the interest of justice so requires. So that clearly signals that the default rule is that the names come out. The judge can override it if the interest of justice so require, and I think that takes you into what Judge Easterbrook is talking about. What does that phrase mean? Well, maybe one looks to this common law tradition.
I agree with that analysis as far as it goes, but what that statute provides above that level of detail is that the plan need not provide for the disclosure of juror names,
but
only
if
it does.
It doesn't say juror names at the trial. I looked at this very carefully right before.
Okay, so you're saying that there's no right to disclosure of the pool. That's not the way that I read the statute, but I can look back at it.
It's 1863 B7, and if you look at B7, it begins by saying, fix the time when the names drawn from the qualified jury wheel shall be disclosed to the parties in public. If the plan permits these names to be made public, it may nevertheless, and so on. So this whole paragraph 7 is about the names drawn from the wheel. Then paragraph 8 moves into the topic of the procedures to be followed in assigning persons whose names have been drawn from the wheel to random petty jury panels. So, and I don't see anything in that statute that regulates the voir dire process one way or the other, or things subsequent to it.
Well, even without the statute, I would say, and I it's not the way that I read it even now, but even without the statute, without relying on the statute, if you review the case law, one thing that I think is crystal clear, and that is that the cases are not uniform about the uniformity of
the procedures.
The
more recent cases are not. I mean, I don't disagree with you there.
And as we argued in the brief, in our view, what that suggests is that juror names are not a core or even a component of what is protected, or of what is presumed to be open under Press Enterprises 1.
That's one possible conclusion, but I think the other possible conclusion, looking at the structure I was suggesting, is that there's a qualified right of access, but it's capable of being overcome if there's a strong interest articulated by the district court judge, and there have been, in the cases you're talking about, some such interests. Might even be here, but we don't have a very good record.
Well, I think that's the wisdom of the jurisdictional cases that we cited early on, in which this court has declined to proceed to the merits, where the court, if the court were to find, for example, here, that a denial of intervention was improper, that the intervener should have been permitted to intervene, then the proper procedure for this court would be to send it back.
Putting the proposed intervener's forfeiture to one side, the problem is it's both a procedural and a substantive problem. Since Judge Zagel never said, here's the time at which I'm going to make this decision, anybody who wants to be heard, step forward. It's hard to complain that the press didn't step forward before he made that decision, and of course it's hard to say that he made the decision in a way that might comply with whatever the Jury Selection and Service Act and common law establishes. On the other hand, the press didn't make any of these arguments in their brief. Anyway, I think we have your position, counsel.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Spears, we asked you a lot of questions, and we also allowed Ms. Bonamici to speak over time, so I'll give you 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that. I'd like to start out on the issue of whether or not after the trial is sufficient. As the Third Circuit discussed in WEC, the importance is during a trial, and as the Ryan example indicates, importance to me had during...
The Third Circuit shockingly did not cite Gannett against DePasquale, right? It's one of the benefits of computer-assisted legal research. You can see that an on-point Supreme Court decision is just ignored by the Third Circuit. It doesn't give confidence in their decision.
They did go through the rest of the history and the points of the benefits of access, though, that all of the other Supreme Court decisions after Gannett have DePasquale have decided. And to say, to criticize what the Tribune's work in Ryan, as the government did, is to argue that we'd be better off with our heads in the sand. That argument promotes ignorance and untruths and an overall secrecy of the process, which is not what our justice system is based on. Knowledge during trial, as the court points out in WECT, allows the public to verify the impartiality of key participants in the administration of justice. During trial, when something can still be done, it also bolsters confidence in the system that the identities of the jurors are known.
That one is planning to verify their impartiality without conducting questioning of the jurors or having background checks performed for which you need not only their names but their addresses and social security numbers and other things. How does one verify their impartiality? I understood your position to be that you were not asking for the questionnaires, which might actually allow such an inquiry. You only wanted the names. So how from the names, without then hiring a private eye to investigate them, does one verify their impartiality?
Well, first of all, it's knowing the name is knowing something about the person, and that bit of information is quite an important one to know.
So maybe your point is that there's an absolutely shocking amount of publicly available information about every person sitting in this courtroom.
Taking it back full circle, as Your Honor pointed out, where back in time everyone knew everyone. It's important to know who someone is.
Suppose you discover that one of the jurors' names is John Smith, and another one is Hector Ruiz. There must be millions of John Smiths and Hector Ruizes in the world. Without getting a lot of other information, you're not going anywhere. So, again, my question is, I could understand if you thought verifying their impartiality or doing something like that was important. You should be asking for the questionnaires, not the names.
Although the names are important, Your Honor, and it's not only the appearance of fairness and openness, but in and of itself, knowing that the media is there, knowing that the public has it available, and encourages truth and candor throughout the process, and there's a certain accountability of standing by one's name. Also, as to Section 1863, I would echo the Court's points about that, as well as the fact that that statute was enacted in 1968.
Can I ask you, were you asking for the names of all the people in the venire, or were you just asking for the names of the people ultimately selected as jurors and alternates?
We were asking for both, Your Honor.
But at this point, it must have been reduced to jurors and alternates? Or are you still interested in the whole venire?
We believe that the entire venire should be open to the public, absent overriding circumstances. That is what has customarily been done. In this case, certainly, the names of the 12 jurors who are deciding the fate of our former governor should be open to the public. On the statute, that statute I wanted to point out was enacted in 1968, prior to the Press Enterprise decision. Also, certainly, neither a statute nor a local rule can override a constitutional right, and should be interpreted consistent with the constitutional right as well as the common law right, and it can be, because that phrase, the interest of justice so require.
In the Northern District's plan implementing the statute on this question?
You mean notes to or commentary towards it?
No, anything concrete in the Northern District plan about whether and if so when jurors' names are released?
Well, the Northern District's plan says that no person shall make public or disclose to any person, unless so ordered by the court, the names drawn by the jury will until the first day of the juror service, which makes it seem as though they will be public, first of all. Second of all, it says any judge of this court, and this is what Judge Wood was referring
to,
may...
But in other words, the plan doesn't go on to tell you when the interest of justice, you know, for example, the interest of justice will require confidentiality in circumstance A, B, C, D. There's no such language in the plan.
That's right. That's why it should be interpreted consistent with the Constitution, of course, and consistent with the common law.
Although it sounds like the plan is saying that one can never get the names of members of the venire who were not chosen as jurors and alternates.
Well, it says that...
How you would read that?
It says it certainly implies that a judge of the court could allow that, but that no one else should allow it until they're seated and sworn.
Part of the answer to Judge Tinder's question is that the defense counsel, if you approach the defense counsel and say, who are the names of the jurors not chosen? It sounds like the defense counsel would have to say, under the terms of the Northern District's plan, I can't tell you that. I can only tell you the names of the people who were chosen.
That could be a possible interpretation of that plan. I think in terms of a constitutional right and a common law right, there's a separate right of the public to have the names, not just the parties to have the names, and that's a separate thing.
You've already heard my worry. One doesn't start with the Constitution. One starts with statutes and plans and common law. And then if one can evaluate the constitutionality of those things, but...
And the common law is...
You don't start here with common law rights of access.
And the common law is a right that we asserted in our papers and believe is an important one and a strong one that the courts vindicated and not overturned unless there were improper purposes in the record. This record is devoid of any concrete threat to the trial, just hypothetical fears that one could conjure up to apply to any case. And the fact that this case is a high publicity case is not in and of itself enough. Otherwise, you could say in all cases of importance, the cases that the public cares about, we're going to cut off the rights, the common law rights, or the First Amendment rights. And, in fact...
Well, look, do you think there would be any problem with a district court saying that the press is telling me that I can't control access to their names and therefore their email addresses? Therefore, in all high-visibility cases, I will sequester the jurors, confiscate their cell phones, and put them in a hotel where there are no computers.
I don't think that's what the district court has to do. In fact, the district court has...
You're not, just answer the question I asked, and then you can tell me what you wish I had asked. My question is, do you think there would be any constitutional problem in doing that? We can ask whether it would be sensible to do that.
I don't think there would be a constitutional problem in doing that. I think that's one of the measures, sequestration.
If the only way to protect the jurors from being bombarded by the press or the general public during a high-visibility trial is to sequester them, not clear that's an improvement in the quality of justice. It's certainly not an improvement in the quality of their lives.
I would agree with that, except that is not the only alternative here. There are alternatives such as instructions to the jury, and as the judge looked at...
Instructions to the jury, first, don't have anything to do with incoming email. And second, we already live in a world where jurors are defying instructions and conducting their own Wikipedia searches during trials, right? Since we know people tend to do that, judges might think that if people are going to contact them, they have nothing to do, no alternative but sequestration.
I would say two things to that, Your Honor.
That's what we want.
Instructions to the jurors have worked, and we can't say that we have to improve the instructions to meet the new media age, which is one of the citations we put in our brief to suggested instructions by the Judicial Conference, but we can't just ignore the reality. And the other thing is, or two other things. One is that you can't presume that the juries are not going to follow instructions and not trust them with that, and yet trust them with the fate of a criminal defendant. We've done for years rested on instructions to juries, and last week the Supreme Court decided the Skilling case and said not only that prominence is not necessarily producing prejudice, which again responds to the high publicity issue, but also underscoring that instructions do work to overcome issues with regard to access.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement and the court will be in recess.